morning, everyone. If anyone's standing and doesn't need to be, go ahead and be seated. We have counsel for appellant is in Detroit Lakes, is that correct?
No, I'm George Duransky. I'm the counsel for the appellant, and I'm in Bemidji.
You're in Bemidji. Sorry, I just... Okay. Thank you, Mr. Duransky. And then can I hear from counsel for respondents? So our camera switches, and I make sure we have everyone here.
Yes, this is Elizabeth Walker, counsel for respondent.
Okay. There you are. Okay. Very good. Okay. We can all hear each other. Everyone's good. Then let's begin the argument. This case is A18-0980, Amy Post, petitioner respondent, versus Samuel Post, appellant. Well, each of you has 15 minutes for argument. Appellant's counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And so each of you, when you begin your argument, just state your name and a party you represent for the record.
Your Honor, my timer is showing 14 minutes and 14 seconds. Could that be reset to 15?
It will reset. And we see you at 15 here, so when you're ready, go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court, Your Honors, Ms. Walker, attendees, and litigants. With regard to this matter, my name is George Duransky. I represent Mr. Post, who is the appellant in this case. I think a short review of some of the facts are critical to an understanding of the background on this case. I'm still showing 1438 and decreasing, but
yep, we're at around 1433.
I'll just go ahead and continue my argument. The clock didn't reset.
Okay.
This is a marriage of some duration. It's also a marriage that involved 6 children, 5 of whom were minors, ranging from 2 years of age to 16 years of age at the time that this matter was litigated. One of the children was an adult. My client was working out of the home at that time as a kitchen manager at a local casino. His wife at that point was running a daycare in their home, which he had participated in and which he was a co-owner over many years. There is no history of violence in this relationship. However, the end of this marriage commenced with an OFP, which essentially involved a fall in a struggle over a door without injuries. There was also a misdemeanor prosecution for essentially communication, which was a violation of the OFP order. There was a suggestion in the brief by Appellee that there was also an indication of stalking. There was a stalking charge at one point, however, that was dismissed by the court, and there was no conviction connected with that matter. The parents, up until the time of the divorce, were really co-parenting all of these children. It was a very intact family. Mr. Post spent lots of time with the children, and there were many times throughout their marriage when he exclusively was taking care of the children, as is reported in the evidence that was submitted to the court and as is referenced in the briefs which we have filed. It was a very shared responsibility. We don't see that often in these cases. Many times we see one parent really having a clearly defined primary parent role. In this case, there was no such definition. There really wasn't a primary parent. There were times when Mr. Post was, for months and even more than a year at a time, essentially responsible for providing all of the care for the children. And there were other times when Mrs. Post was doing the same thing. I don't mean to diminish her role, but I don't want his role diminished either. This was a family that worked together to raise 6 children, which 6 children is a lot of kids to raise. It's kind of an all hands on deck proposition. And I think that that's the kind of family that we had. There was a business where the daycare was run, which was 2 hours away from where the house was located. And so as a result of that, there was a certain amount of proximity in a very small town in northern Minnesota. And there was a lot of dissension. There's no question that this was a very combative kind of case, not in a physical sense, but in a sense of a lot of arguing back and forth. That all occurred. When Judge Rasmussen got this case, he appointed a custody evaluator, or in this case, Ms. Haskins, who was essentially assigned the task of making reports and bringing them to the attention of the court, which brings me kind of to my first major point, and that is that Ms. Haskins very quickly developed a very obvious bias toward against Mr. Post. In fact, at one time he presented a picture to her that he had taken of a car outside his wife's house, which is, remembering, only two doors away. He wanted to show her that picture because he was afraid there was a man in his children's life and he wanted to identify that person and find out what kind of a person he was. She essentially caused that to be reported as a violation and claimed that she was a mandated reporter, and so essentially she caused a charge to be brought against Mr. Post. In addition to that, she also used that as leverage in court to advocate for a suspension of unsupervised visitation and for him to be only allowed supervised visitation. So very early in this case, there was a very big difference in terms of what Ms. Haskins thought about Mr. Post and what he thought about Mom in this case. And there are a couple other facts that become really important. Once Mr. Post was out of the child care business, which he was a part of, immediately their older daughter was put into that position. So she became mother's business partner early in these proceedings. And as a result of that, she very much sided with her mother. The grandparents who lived locally, or at least Mr. Post's mother, also sided strongly with Mrs. Post because she was providing a lot of care for all of these children and really didn't want them out of her life. And she felt that the best way to keep them in her life was to essentially side with Mom in this case. Time passed, and a long period of time passed without Mr. Post really having any meaningful communication with his children. And as a result of that, there was a real separation which took place during that period of time. My concern in this case is, except for the OFP, and there really isn't anything in the OFP or in any of the proceedings up until the time of the OFP that suggests that Mr. Post was anything other than a real good dad and was very responsible and very caring and very involved in his children's lives. He went to school events. He went to conferences. He attended their activities. He planned activities recreationally with those children on a regular basis. And that's all delineated in the court transcript. But still, we came to the point where Mr. Post was asked to get a psychological evaluation. He did. He hired a psychologist. He pursued that. And he spent about 6.5 hours in an evaluation, and it came back that except for the stress of the litigation, he was a good dad. And there was a suggestion made that Mrs. Post also obtain a psychological evaluation. She refused, and none ever took place. When Ms. Haskins got to the point that she was getting close to trial on this case, she released her report, and it was only a couple of days before the trial. Mr. Post asked for more time for the trial because he wanted to get another custody evaluation involved. That was denied. And as a result, he was basically forced to go to trial with the evidence as it had developed, which essentially was developed by Ms. Haskins. It troubles me in this case that Ms. Haskins wasn't simply taken off of this case. After those incredibly strong biases developed, I tried to explain. And I don't know if custody evaluators really have a code of ethics, but I looked at the ethics code for, and it's quoted in the brief, the ethics code for custody evaluations which are done by psychologists. And it's very clear, if you look at those ethical standards, that Ms. Haskins walked all over those standards and continued to pursue this case when she really should have recused herself, stepped off the case, and not been involved in that part of the decision making.
Can I ask about the continuance issue? You're saying, so the report came in from the, I suppose
yes.
That your client was expecting, or was he not expecting a report from the custody evaluator?
Was expecting a report, but he was expecting that it would occur somewhat before the trial, and it came in very last minute.
Was there some time frame by which it was established, by which it was due? Was it late under any deadline or anything?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I would assume, being familiar with Judge Rasmussen's orders and having read a dozen of them, that usually those reports are required by the guardian at least 10 days or 20 days before trial.
Okay,
I don't remember what the order said in this case, but I'm sure there was
a time limit
for the preparation and exchange of the report.
And from what I can tell, counsel,
on the fact that the record, since I didn't try the case, the record indicates that request was made for a continuance in order to get further input from another custody evaluator. The judge denied that and went forward with the trial. So
I guess my point on that is, couldn't he have anticipated?
Honestly, answer that question about the number of days.
Counsel, I guess my question about that is, could he not have anticipated that he might need a custody that he might want to get his own custody evaluation done? You know, he waits until like a few days, until he gets it, 10, let's even say it was 10 days before trial. That's pretty short. I mean, he might have given some thought to that prior to then, right? Maybe that's why the court did not.
I can answer the question, but I have to exercise a little bit of license when I answer this. Ms. Haskins is one of the only custody evaluators up here. In the CHIPS process, where there are a lot of guardian ad litems that would do custody evaluations, they aren't permitted to do so by our local guardian ad litem program. And so first, there aren't very many people to pick from. The second issue becomes a matter of cost. Litigation becomes expensive, living in a separate household becomes expensive, paying attorney's fees become expensive. And I think it's pretty easy to understand why a person would make a decision to say, let's see what this other report says before I try to do anything further with it. Just from the standpoint of the economics of litigation, it's very easy to spend tens of thousands of dollars on one of these cases, and custody evaluators charge too. Mm-hmm. And quite a bit of the burden of that was put on Mr. Post. And as a result of that, I think it's understandable why he waited. I certainly wouldn't have suggested that he wait, and I might have been exploring that possibility earlier. But we run into this on a really regular basis. And I say that because I'm a contract attorney in the CHIPS program up here and represent parents. I did 12 hearings on Tuesday of this week. And so I'm kind of familiar with the interplay between custody evaluators and guardian ad litems. And we simply don't have them. We don't have them available. And Ms. Haskins is one of the few who is available. And so sometimes as litigators, whether we like it or we don't like it, you have a choice of one at this smorgasbord.
Thank you. Go ahead. Thank you for that answer.
Mr. Duransky, it was not as clear to me that the district court relied so heavily on the opinions of the custody evaluator as your argument would assert. Can you direct us to the parts of the district court's order where you are, you know, really feeling that that occurred?
When the court did the evaluation, the 152 evaluation of the best interest of the child, it seems that almost every point that there was an opportunity to go one or two ways. I mean, the only psychologist who testified in this case was Dr. Weinzerl, if I'm not mispronouncing her name, and she testified strongly in favor of Mr. Post. And yet her opinion is essentially downgraded by the court and isn't treated very seriously. Ms. Walker makes kind of a disparaging remark about her and says, well, she only saw him for 2 hours and she didn't follow up on any collaterals. There's testimony to that effect in the record, which indicates that she did in fact follow up on collaterals, and she felt that she followed up on anything she needed to follow up on. And it wasn't a 2 hour quickie kind of psychological evaluation. There was about 2 hours that was actually spent just getting background information from Mr. Post, and then about another 4.5 hours, which were done in testing and interviewing. And so there was far more definitive, and she did testify, analysis that was done by her. And I think it was kind of brushed aside without really bothering to take a look at what it said. And there was reliance on a witness that Mr. Post had filed a HIPAA complaint against and was successful in court, and she was testifying against Mr. Post, and he won his judgment and collected his judgment in HIPAA because of those violations, and yet the court was perfectly willing to see her testimony as important and credible, even though it was supporting his wife in this case, and that's pretty thoroughly explained also in this matter. And this is a man who has no criminal history, no history of violence, no police calls, no reports from police officers coming to the house, disturbances, disorderly conducts, bar issues, any of that kind of stuff. This guy's a homebody who was taking care of his kids. And now he's put in a position where he gets a 5-minute phone call, which is clocked. He gets practically no communication with his children. He has very limited visitation, which is much less than the 25%, which is more or less required by statutes. And he finds himself in a position of having to fight just to get some meaningful communication with 6 children that he's raised for 15, 20 years. I just think this is wrong. I do have to mention very briefly the fact that there's a couple of financial issues here, and I don't want to not mention them and then have the court not think that they are important to us. But there's a workman's comp payment in here, which is very clearly non-marital property. And that was not recognized by the court as an offset against any of the division of property. The property was divided relatively equally, but a fairly substantial workman's comp payment was avoided, and the judge divided, even though that was the situation. I see now the clock has stopped running at 7 seconds. My time has expired. Unless the court has any questions, I'll sit down and yield the floor to Ms. Walker.
Sure, you'll have time for a rebuttal as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you ready for me to begin?
Oh, sorry, yes. Sorry, go ahead.
May it please the court, thank you for your time and consideration of this issue today. Before I go into my own speech that I had prepared, I would like to touch on a few things that Mr. Duransky had brought up. There is sufficient testimony in the transcripts that talk about how Mr. Post said he was a co-owner and helped with the daycare, and Ms. Post said no, that was not true. Ms. Post also denied that Mr. Post went months or years at a time being the primary caregiver, and that all of those facts were stated by both parties to the judge, and the judge decided as he saw. The custody evaluator that was appointed was an agreement that was made between me and Mr. Post's attorney at that time. I had provided him 3 names and their hourly rate. Mr. Post's attorney at that time chose Ms. Haskins because he had worked with her in the past. There was a request for a continuance by Mr. Post. However, the fact, and you can look at the court record on Mintz's, this case had been extended so many times that Judge Rasmussen was just not willing to have a continuance once again. And there were so many other issues that were related. Also to note, in Mr. Rasmussen's findings, he states that the order for protection and the divorce trial were consolidated for the purposes of the trial. So there was a request to continue the order for protection after the date of the trial, which was granted. Mr. Duransky keeps coming back to the fact that my client had agreed to have a psychological evaluation. First of all, it was never court ordered. It was requested by opposing counsel. My client agreed to it while the parties were in marriage counseling, but at that time, Mr. Post had disagreed, and he didn't get an evaluation until during the order for protection period when it was court ordered to do so. At no point was she requested by the custody evaluator or the judge to go get a psychological evaluation. And there is a cost that becomes prohibitive in those kind of things, especially when she was solely financially in charge of taking care of all 6 of their children. Mr. Duransky also stated that Mr. Post substantially carried the cost of the custody evaluator. Again, that's not true. If we go back to the findings, There was money that was held in a trust account from the sale of the 508 Main Street property. The custody evaluator was paid from those trust funds, which were divided equally between the parties. In fact, Mr. Post received $8,000 in addition for a property settlement purposes. And if Mr. Duransky keeps saying that the custody evaluator's report was solely relied on, that is simply a fallacy. There's plenty of testimony where my client said that she was pushed, that she was yelled at, that he made death threats if he ever left her, if she ever left him. There was a daughter that we were forced to have come testify as a witness that she saw it as well. We even utilized the appellant's mother as a witness for our side to talk about his behaviors. Mr. Post had the opportunity, appellant had the opportunity to bring witnesses, just like my client did. They had the opportunity to cross-examine my witnesses. I had the same amount of time for preparation for trial as Mr. Post's previous attorney. These arguments just fall on their face. And in fact, Judge Rasmussen clearly considered all of the best interest factors under 518.17a in the findings. And in fact, he even brought up that the parties were unable to communicate and he had a finding of domestic abuse. And it was based upon the witness's testimony. Yes, it was corroborated in the custody evaluator's report from all of this stuff, but she had a cornucopia of information that the judge that were that is otherwise not available to the judge. So it just supported what the witnesses I had brought before the court. Dr. Weinzierl did come in, and we did cross-examine her, and I'm not disparaging her at all. There's a fact, and I believe it's in my brief, that there were three other counselors that were utilized by the parties, and they all had similar findings, and those reports were made available to the custody evaluator. No other counselor came to testify. So again, Mr. Duransky is saying that there was a witness of this, and her name is escaping me right now, and I'm sorry. There was a witness of the woman who he won a case against. She was never called to testify. She was not there. So her report was reviewed, and in fact, opposing counsel agreed to let that report be entered in the record. And again, they had the opportunity to say no because we didn't have the counselor there. We couldn't lay foundation. I mean, like George Duransky said, these cases get to be really, really expensive, especially when you go through trial. When you use a professional witness, like a counselor, you've got to pay them between $180 to $200 an hour for preparation, travel, and attendance. This was almost a two-day trial. So they would have to sit there the entire time waiting to be called. And we just couldn't afford it. That's why that we didn't have those reports initially entered into evidence until after Mr. Johnson agreed to allow that to be entered.
Could you speak to the issue of parenting time, please? Is that issue the less than 25%? Can we review it?
Yes.
Is it before us? And what's the justification for it?
In appellant's brief, he brings up the fact that my client was provided less than 25% of the time. On several occasions, Judge Rasmussen stated in his findings that the appellant was unable to put his own needs aside for the care of his children. And there were several samples of that brought before the court. And I believe that's the finding for less than 25% of the time. Now, the parties can agree to more time if things are going well. That was also put in the order, that if the parties agree to more time, then that's fine. But here we have a substantial amount of evidence where his own daughter testified against him. She didn't have an economic need at the time. She was in high school. She wasn't a co-owner. That's since changed, but not at the time of testimony. And there is also another daughter that's brought into this where the judge finds that Maya, the second oldest child, shall not be forced to have parenting time. And those are very important findings that alludes to believe that there is a reason that Mr. Post should not have more time with his children. mean, as it is, he's already getting more time than the custody evaluator recommended. She wanted supervised time. He's getting weekends unsupervised, and he's allowed to come to all activities and be involved in the children's lives. Because, so I don't know. I mean, the judge did not directly state, I will admit, the judge did not directly state in his order the reason for less than 25% of the time. But I don't believe that's the requirement under the law if he makes findings that are sufficient to state that there should be less than 25% of the time. Did I answer your question?
Thank you,
Your
yes.
Honor? Mm-hmm. I have 6 minutes left, and I don't get to have a rebuttal. So I'm going to jump to the property issues really quick. Parties own.
I think your clocks are a little bit. You have like 6:30 left, and I'll give you. So don't worry about that, and also on rebuttal, counsel. Don't worry about the timing. You'll be able to say what you need to say. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. Both parties made non-marital claims. Even in the transcript, my client stated she was given $10,000 in two $5,000 gifts of each. Appellant agreed with that, even in his own testimony, of $5,000, just the $5,000. And then the concerning part about his non-marital claim is that number seems to be a moving target. In the appellant's original brief, he claimed that he contributed $21,000, but then a page later he said, well, it's at least $30,000. When you read the settlement offer, which was a part of the exhibits, he was only received $19,200. And my client in testimony said she thought, she wasn't sure, it was $15,000. But she didn't know for sure because they didn't use all of the money that he received just for that. And there was no clear finding. I mean, even the bank statement that was provided or the mortgage statement that was provided, the amount reduced substantially. So I don't know how you can make a non-marital claim with that. Also, the settlement paperwork, the documents, is not clear for what time period that settlement covers. If it was for lost wages during the time period when the parties were married as well, or if it was for retraining, all of that is a marital asset, not a non-marital asset. And because it was unclear, and even appellant in the transcript on page 157, line 17 says it was not stated as what the settlement covered. And because the parties were married at the time that he received it, he deposited it into a marital account, he used it for a marital asset, and he could not prove the exact dollar amount that he deposited. And it seems to be a moving target. That's the part that's frustrating. We have never seen why he thinks it's $30,000 now, but you know, it is what it is. But both parties were denied their non-marital claim. And also, appellant gave over and over and over again a litany of personal property items that he wanted. And some of them my client said she already gave to him, and she had testified that she'd already given him half of all of the linens, all the blankets, half of all, you know, even movies for the kids, toys for the kids. Those were already divided. And he came again with this litany of a list that was so long and incredible. My client would be like, well, I already gave him that. I already gave him that. He can have that. I already gave him that. And instead of going line by line, my client said she's done with it. She wanted to give him a $5,000 personal property settlement offer just to be done with it and cut it clean. However, appellant was awarded an $8,000 personal property settlement. And because of the splitting of the trust money, the equity in the house that he was granted, and that $8,000 award, appellant received a substantial amount of money to be able to get himself set up again. He continues at this point, my client continues to support financially for the majority, the children. Five children, she does a home business, that's the way it is. In conclusion, I don't believe the appellant met his burden that the trial court acted with abuse of discretion in deciding physical custody, legal custody, or parenting time. I think the court was very diligent in considering all of the facts. And I don't think the custody evaluator, whether or not, was heavily relied upon within the order. Also, I don't believe, although non-marital claims are reviewed de novo, I don't believe that the trier of fact, did not find that either party substantially proved their non-marital claims, and therefore equitably divided the property pretty much down the line. Now, what this comes to me, is this is this typical scenario of somebody not liking what a judge has decided. That's what this comes down to. And that's unfortunate, and I understand that he doesn't like it. But, and quite frankly, I'm empathetic. However, the fact that he doesn't like it is not a reason for an appeal. He has the opportunity down the road to do a motion for modification. There are other, if he does the work he needs to do and there's no findings of further harm from him, why can't he do that? He certainly can, just like anybody else who has an order from the court. Does the court have any further questions for me?
No, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And is there a rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to start with the financial issues because they're pretty completely delineated in the brief. And I think if the court simply reads what is written in the brief, that the position becomes pretty understandable. Without regard to pinning down the exact number, whether it was 21 or 19 or 11, or what she vaguely remembered was just a couple of thousand dollars, it's pretty clear in here that a bunch of money went in to the purchase of that homestead, and it looks like it was $21,000 from the documents that were submitted to the court. The point is that that wasn't given any consideration by the trial court and was not used as a set-off in the division. The equity was divided 50-50, but there was simply, without regard to what finding the court might have made as to what the premarital contribution was, there certainly isn't any effort to factor that into the decision. And I think that's the main problem. I want to talk a little bit more about the custody issues because it's really significant in this case. While it's somewhat disputed, the parties did run this daycare business together. And there were times when Mr. Post was in charge of it. There were times when his wife was in charge of it. There were times when they were both working in it. There were times with six children where one of them or the other one was pulling an outside job, and so more of the child care business fell on the other party. During that period of time, hundreds of children went through that daycare. There was never a single complaint against Mr. Post for any child being mistreated in that facility or for any of the emotional or psychological issues that are relied upon by the appellee in this case in terms of saying, well, he was fault at this and fault that, and he was hot-headed and he spanked kids when he shouldn't and all that. There just isn't any evidence of that. Not only are we talking about six children, but we're talking about dozens of other children that went through that daycare over the course of time. And it's still operational. It hasn't changed or shut down. There's been nothing that has taken it away. Still being run today. Mr. Post doesn't have any interest in it anymore, but it's still an operational entity. It wasn't closed under disgraceful circumstances or anything of the kind. Of the witnesses who were called, and there were essentially five, obviously Dr. Wetzel was the one with the greatest credentials, and she testified in front of Mr. Post, and basically her testimony was rejected by the court. Shannon Kempf was the person who testified that Mr. Post was delusional. She's the one who paid a financial judgment to him because he successfully sued her for a HIPAA violation. Susan Gray, his mother, was the estranged mother of Mr. Post, who essentially testified against him. Rita Anderson was rejected by Ms. Haskins. Her testimony was completely destroyed in Ms. Haskins' report. And what did she say? She said there's no sign of any thought disorder. Winter Post, their oldest child, was essentially out of the life of Mr. Post at the time of trial. And when it came time in trial to ask her questions, and I think this is kind of compelling, and I think it says quite a bit about Mr. Post. she was put on the stand, not by Mr. Post, but by Mom in this case. And she was put through the arduous task of testifying against her father. And if you read the record, what happened when the judge said, all right, your witness, counsel, and turned it over to Mr. Post's attorney for questioning of his adult daughter, he indicated to the court that he was directing his attorney not to cross-examine his daughter, that he felt that it was a hard enough thing for her to have been already put through. If you want to see a sign of who's compassionate, who has the best interests of the children at heart, who is the real parent in this situation, don't you think that that step by Mr. Post says more than anything that was said from the witness chair? He was saying, enough. I don't want to carry this battle against my wife to the point of further destroying my child. So I rest. And it's time for the court to give Mr. Post what he's entitled to, the money that he has coming from the disproportionate division, and a reasonable parenting schedule where he has meaningful contact with children that he has never done anything to earn the rejection of the court from. Thank you for your time and attention, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you both. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. And that concludes our oral calendar this morning. We're in recess.